Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
It's just a beautiful thing. It's been a beautiful few days. I keep trying to keep from crying.
The Alaska Native community reacts to Mary Peltola's historic special election win. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 2nd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, new COVID boosters target the original strain and Omicron variants.
It's teaching your body, kind of think of it like teaching 2 languages instead of 1. It's telling it 2 different ways to look at this virus.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's environment and economy and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help prevent the spread of invasive species by remembering to play clean go, removing all plants, animals, and mud from boots, gear, and vehicles before entering and leaving recreational areas will help stop invasive species in their tracks. Learn more at playcleango.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Democrats around the country are celebrating Mary Peltola's win in the special election for U.S. House. When she's sworn in mid-September, Peltola will add to the slim Democratic majority. Peltola, though, is of course not just a Democrat. She's also Yupik, and many Alaska Native people took to social media to express a joy that goes beyond politics. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
Lorelei Ivanoff is a writer in Unalakleet. She's Inupiaq. She doesn't even know Peltola personally. She learned the news from Twitter.
It was just simple, like Mary Peltola, next U.S. Congresswoman. And I like screamed and let that news sink in. And then like these tears came out and I was not expecting that.
Ivanoff says it made her realize that she's never had a representative in Washington who holds Native values and a Native perspective. She says there was an outpouring of joy, online and off.
A friend of mine celebrated with a king crab dinner in Nome. People like were lighting up their mucklies, their steam houses and saunas to celebrate and just like enjoy the day, right?
It's a hope for the opportunity to build an Alaska that, you know, we all live in and dream about.
Megan Anders in Nome says the election feels like a bit of atonement for the historical harm done to Native people. The relocations, like that of her family from King Island, the language loss, the suppression of Native cultures, much of it was done by the federal government. Now a Native person will be in Congress making federal law. Anders says it's something all Alaskans can feel proud of.
It's a really a tremendous day for American democracy. I believe that Representative-elect Peltola will share her strengths, the strength of our ancestors, with Congress.
Anchorage engineer Dave Katachik Nikolai is Yupik. His family is from Kwikuk, where Peltola spent her early years and her mom is from. He says part of the joy for him was telling his young daughters that, at least until January, they'll have a representative in D.C. who looks like them.
My third grader understands it a little bit. She looked at me and she got her face beamed up and she got a big smile on her face and she said, "Really?" And so that was very special to me, too.
For Lorelei Ivanoff in Unalakleet, the news has sunk in, but the emotional high continues.
It's just a beautiful thing. It's been a beautiful few days. I keep trying to keep from crying.
For now, Peltola supporters are celebrating. But to keep the seat beyond January, she will have to win another election, the regular general in November. She'll be on the ballot with Republicans Sarah Palin and Nick Begich and Libertarian Chris Bye. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaskans will have access to updated COVID boosters next week, state health officials say. State physician Dr. Lisa Rabinowitz says the state expects to receive doses early next week. Local providers will start distributing them soon after.
They'll be widely available across the state in healthcare centers, public health clinics, pharmacies, and then there are some pop-up clinics that are scheduled in some communities throughout the state.
The state is working with tribal partners to distribute boosters in rural communities, and companies like Fairweather will set up clinics in urban areas. The CDC recommended the updated COVID boosters this week. They target two versions of the virus, the original strain and the Omicron variant. Alaska's chief medical officer, Dr. Ann Zink, says it's a welcome update.
It's teaching your body, kind of think of it like teaching two languages instead of one. It's telling it two different ways to look at this virus.
Moderna's booster is for adults 18 and older, and Pfizer's is for those 12 and up. You're only eligible if it's been 2 months since your last COVID vaccine. You don't have to wait 2 months after a COVID infection, but Zink says it might be a good idea. Infections give you increased protection for a few months, and waiting on the booster can help prolong your immunity. If you have certain risk factors, that guidance might change.
Legally, you can get it if you've had COVID within a month. However, clinically, it may be better to wait, and that's why we'd recommend talking to your provider.
Free at-home COVID tests from the federal government are no longer available as of today. The program was suspended due to a lack of funding from Congress. At-home tests are available for purchase from pharmacies. Insurance may partially or fully cover the costs of tests, and Rabinowitz says the state still has tests to send to public health clinics, libraries, and other community partners. On the Yukon River, both the fall chum salmon and the coho salmon are nearing the ends of their runs. State biologists do not expect the numbers of either species to meet their goals for fish reaching their spawning grounds. But KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports both have arrived in higher numbers than last year's record low.
An estimated 95% of the fall chum salmon run is past the lower river. So far, the state-run sonar at Pilot Station has counted just over 200,000 fall chum. That's about 40% of the historical median of over a 500,000 fall chum by this time.
A little bit of good news is this year the fall chum run is coming in better than what it did the last 2 years.
State Fishery Manager Christy Gleason spoke during a Yukon River salmon teleconference on Tuesday.
So this does give us some hope for the future that it's at least the run is improving a little bit.
Yukon River fall chum salmon hit a record low last year. So did coho salmon. Coho are also tracking above their low point. The coho run numbers so far closely match the 2020 run. An estimated over three quarters of the coho run has passed the lower river. So far, the state-run sonar at Pilot Station has counted about 64,000 coho. That's just over half of the historical average of 116,000 coho by this time. The composition of the runs have also changed. Body length for both the returning coho and fall chum is smaller than their historical average, based on salmon sampled by state biologists. The fall chum that have returned are slightly older than the historical average and with slightly fewer females than the historical average. Fishing for both species remains closed on the Yukon for the second year in a row. Fishery Manager Gleason thanked everyone on the river for their sacrifice.
And I hope we can get back to fishing in the future. We really look forward to seeing fish camps open and nets in the water and people putting up fish for the winter when the run is large enough to allow for harvest.
Reporting for KYUK, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Coming up, a roving grammarian and her grammar table visit Anchorage.
I hope in a way that the table serves to remind people of this wonderful medium we have in common, which is language. It's pretty exciting.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at NEAAlaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
The Homer-based company Salmon Sisters launched a line of apparel earlier this month that's getting a lot of attention. Hundreds of comments on social media have called their new clothing design cultural appropriation. KBBI's Desiree Hagen reached out to a few of the commenters and has this story.
Salmon Sisters is a small company founded over a decade ago by sisters Emma Teal Lukaitis and Claire Neaton. They have two retail stores in Homer and sell their products internationally through their website. They pride themselves on being conscientious. The brand's all-woman team sells boxes of wild halibut, sablefish, Pacific cod, and salmon. They also manage a clothing line marketed to women with designs inspired by coastal Alaska. Recently, the sisters partnered with a Montana-based company to produce a hooded form-fitting tunic sided with blueberry pattern panels and retailing for about $170. Their ad shows a thin, light-skinned model picking berries. The dress is a play on a design the Montana company Euler has been making for almost 10 years. They refer to it as the Seaworthy and Blueberry dress, but other people call it by a different name.
A lot of people know these quote-unquote dresses as cusbucks. That's the most used word. That's a Yupik word, but back in our area, we say atikflup.
That's Jackie Lambert. She's a Inupiaq, and she sees Salmon Sisters' dress as part of a larger pattern of cultural appropriation.
You know, we've made all these inventions that in the past have always been recreated, and now they're common items like the ulu or the kayak or sunglasses even. The biggest thing is that they are stealing from us. They are stealing income from creators that literally live off of making these atik looks.
Lambert took issue with how much she said the dress looks like gusbucks and atik looks. A hooded overshirt with a large front pocket commonly worn by Alaska Native people. Hundreds of commenters criticized the Salmon Sisters for claiming it was their original design. Lambert says she wishes the Salmon Sisters use their platform to work with Alaska Native seamstresses who are currently creating these garments, and many other commenters agreed. Lambert was also upset at the Salmon Sisters' immediate response to that criticism. Comments accusing the sisters of cultural appropriation or pointing to similarities between their design and modern gusbucks were immediately deleted, which the Salmon Sisters later said was because their small staff was initially overwhelmed. But most of the comments received a lengthy cut-and-paste response. The Salmon Sisters declined a radio interview, but responded to the request with a revised version of that original response. They said, quote, "We hear your voices and we are sorry for failing to recognize that our recent dress release appeared to be influenced or inspired by Alaska Indigenous gusbuck design without appropriate credit," end quote. Nicolette Corbett is a registered nurse, gusbuck maker, and teacher working out of Soldotna. She's the owner of So Yupik. That so is spelled S-E-W. She says sewing gusbucks is like therapy for her, and that wearing and creating them connects her to her Yupik culture.
Especially when I'm out berry picking and I'm using the gusbucks that my grandmothers, they have created, I feel even more connected to my grandmothers in those moments while I'm out gathering.
Corbett says she's not sure the dress looks exactly like the gusbucks that her grandmother made. She said it would be interesting to have an elder's perspective on this. In the days following the dress's release, the Salmon Sisters changed the language on their product page saying, quote, "These dresses are meant to be multifunctional, versatile garments to dress up or down, wear outside or put to work. In these ways, they share similarities with the Alaska Native gusbucks," end quote. They posted resources for customers to learn more about gusbucks with links to work by Alaska Native artists on their website. They also pledged to donate proceeds from their Seaworthy and Blueberry dresses to SeaShare, an organization working to feed villages along the Lower Yukon River, where salmon runs are crashing. Maya Kutuk-Lukin is the former mayor of Kotzebue and now works in Wasilla for the Park Service. She is a Inupiaq. Her initial post criticizing Salmon Sisters' design went viral. Lukin says it's important to put these conversations in a cultural and historic context.
People don't understand what happened to Alaskans and, you know, our parents and grandparents who were taken to boarding school and punished for speaking our language and punished for wearing our traditional attire, which included atik looks and kusbucks.
Lukin said the Salmon Sisters' design was, quote, "absolutely cultural appropriation." but she was sympathetic to the sisters who made the mistake in such a public way. She believes it's important for both Indigenous people and non-Native allies to vocalize issues when they encounter them.
The best thing that we can do is educate people and speak up. People need to speak up for what's right, and what's right is understanding First Alaskans.
When pressed for further comment for this story, the Salmon Sisters responded saying, quote, "This is an opportunity for Salmon Sisters to respectfully listen and learn from Alaska's Indigenous voices." Reporting in Homer, I'm Desiree Hagen.
Across the country, housing prices are climbing, and many people are struggling to afford to live in their own communities. In Petersburg, rising prices have combined with another factor, a simple lack of space. KFSK's Catherine Monahan spoke with people affected by the housing crunch and has this story.
Chase Kirby recently began a job as a police officer in Petersburg. He says the chief made it clear during the interview that housing is hard to come by here.
So we had a forewarning of it. Wasn't really expecting it to be this hard.
Kirby has a wife, three children, six dogs, and one cat. They're all waiting back in Utah while he tries to find at least a three-bedroom house. He's working with a realtor, and the borough is reaching out on his behalf, but nothing has opened up so far. Meanwhile, Kirby is staying in the firehouse.
I've got one bedroom to myself. I share the kitchen, rest area, workout room, you know, all of the common areas with anybody else that's at the fire station at the time. It makes some weird noises at night when you think you're by yourself, just the way the building settles. It's not horrible, but it's not home.
He says that he and his family miss each other. He's heard that some homes may become available several months from now, but nothing definite. Just in the past few years, housing has become a big issue in this small fishing community. Much of the nation is experiencing a lack of affordable housing, and many people have had to move to cheaper areas with longer commutes. But like many southeast towns, Petersburg is on an island, so commuting from out of town isn't an option. Here's real estate agent Sarah Holmgren.
The rental market is very tight, as well as the home sales market. It's difficult to find rentals right now that can accommodate really anybody more than a person or even more than a couple, and there's very few homes for sale.
A quick online search shows two homes for sale in Petersburg and zero rentals, but 15 Airbnbs are available. Holmgren says that's one area of Petersburg's housing market that has grown.
And that's where I think a lot of our rentals have either disappeared into that, or as people have developed rentals, they become Airbnbs.
That lack of rentals limits the options for people who are trying to make a transition in their lives, whether they're hoping to move into a situation, like Kirby with his new job, or out of one. Annette Bennett is the director of WAVE, a nonprofit organization that offers assistance to people in Petersburg who are impacted by violence.
If today you had to pick up and leave, you know, where would you go? There just isn't an option. Not even like a motel, really, that you can kind of go and just stay long term, like for a month or something. And so that puts people choosing to stay in an unhealthy or unsafe space because there just isn't, they'd rather do that than be homeless. And there's also some people that choose to live in their cars because they can't live at home anymore.
Another group that's affected by the shortage is local employers. Some are having a hard time attracting essential workers. Borough manager Steve Giesbrecht says the borough has been trying for 6 months to fill its fire EMS director position, and several finalists have backed out, citing housing as a reason.
We have a workforce problem, but we have a housing problem too, and solving both of those go hand in hand. I mean, we can bring more workers to town, but if they can't find a place to live, then they can't move here. So it's going to be very difficult to fix the lack of workforce without fixing the housing side of it.
The borough is looking into creating additional lots that people could build houses on. However, Giesbrecht says it's very expensive to extend roads and utilities to new areas.
Generally, what we see is by the time the infrastructure is put in place, the value of the lots is so high that people can't afford them. So, you know, and then that'll be the assembly's decision on, you know, do you subsidize the prices of the lots so that they get them down to a little bit lower so people can afford to buy and build.
The borough is also interested in creative solutions. It hopes to lease units from the U.S. Coast Guard and make them available for Petersburg first responders. And one assembly member plans to introduce a proposal for tiny homes. In Petersburg, I'm Catherine Monahan.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com. Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
Officials from the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium are traveling to rural communities around the state to promote a service offered by its energy program, providing solar panel systems to help bring down costly electric bills. KRBD's Reagan Miller reports.
Solar panels have been mounted on the roof of Klawock's water treatment plant for 2 years, and more could be coming. Katya Karankevich works for the consortium's energy program.
Our primary mission is to lower water and sewer bills and energy bills for rural customers. Primarily, we work with tribes and cities in rural Alaska to do projects, renewable energy projects, energy efficiency projects that fundamentally and ultimately reduce their bills.
She was in Klawock working on a video she hopes will get the word out to rural areas.
And then we can send that video to the 229 tribes in the state, a lot of which might not know that we have a little program in ANTHC that will come and consult and for free help develop an energy project.
What's on top of Klawock's water plant is called an array, which is a collection of solar panels that work as one system to generate energy. Karankevich says that just the one small array has saved Klawock's utility somewhere between $500 and $600 a year.
If we put in a community-sized system, a utility-scale system, and have somebody like the tribe or the city own that asset and sell power to the local utility, now the local utility can write off all of the cost of that power purchasing it from that other entity. They can write it off and get the full PCE reimbursement.
PCE stands for Power Cost Equalization. It's a state program that brings down the cost of electricity in eligible rural areas to rates seen in more urban areas. Karankevich says that more arrays could be in Klawock's future after what she says was a successful meeting with the tribe.
They have interest in installing arrays on all of the tribal buildings that they have access to here.
She says she's looking into whether Klawock's power utility is interested in the option. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Alaska grammar nerds will be heartened to know that a self-described roving grammarian is in the state dispensing advice. Ellen Jovan is a language teacher, author of the book Rebel with a Clause, and literally the woman behind the grammar table, where she sits awaiting grammar and general language questions from passersby. Jovan calls the Upper West Side of Manhattan home, and Alaska is the grammar table's 49th state, with only Hawaii remaining. Jovan had the grammar table set up in front of Tidal Wave Books in Anchorage today, complete with several reference books and a friendly attitude. And Jovan says that's the idea. She's not here to scold people about their grammar. She just wants to talk.
Well, the original idea just came to me at home. So it was originally not all over the country. It was outside of our apartment building. And I just thought it'd be fun to be on the street and talk to people about language. I was sick of being on the computer all the time. So there are lots of language groups on social media, on Facebook, for example. And it's cool because you can talk to people in any part of the world. But then eventually I found I was not having enough face-to-face time. So I wanted light, air conversation with human beings where I could see what they, you know, were doing with their hands and their faces. And so I just did it one day in the fall of 2018 and people came up to me right away. And I've been doing it ever since.
What was it like in the pandemic, though? Did you have to pack things up and just kind of put it on hold?
I did, and we had just, when the pandemic hit, we had gone to 47 states. So we were missing Hawaii, Alaska, and Connecticut. But I had a deadline for a book, so I just stayed home and wrote the book and waited for things to clear up.
Gotcha. How does it usually go? I mean, how does this work with people? And then how are they different around the country?
So usually when we show up someplace, we have to figure out where to go. there are considerations with the grammar table that one might not think of. You have to have, first of all, the weather. I'm now weather obsessed because I cannot get my books wet. But so we look around for traffic-y places, and often they're near coffee shops or ice cream shops. Those are great locations often. And I plop down and then people start coming up. And, you know, it may be that the traffic is thinner than some other places, but eventually someone will come talk to me. It always happens. And I'd say the variations are, you hear it mostly in the pronunciation. That varies more. I can't really, do I sound like I have an accent to you?
I can't tell.
Yeah, because I can't tell with you either. So that's not really something I'm experiencing here. But there might be like local slang that I don't know about. In the South, when I was in the South, that's where I had the biggest difference. Because that, you know, it sounds quite different. I was a Yankee there, clearly. And I also think there's, in some places, there's more of a table culture. Like some places, people are used to having tables on the street, and others, I think they're more confused that there's a table there than that there's a grammar table there. Yeah. Like either way, it's weird.
And then, I mean, how does that work? Like, and maybe it's different with different people, but what's kind of like the typical interaction like?
There's a lot of variety. What I enjoy a lot is when people just come right up to me, they don't even look surprised, and they just ask a grammar question without saying hello, because that just feels like, okay, this is a service that makes sense to people. And I just get a kick out of that. Other times people will stand about 20 feet away as though they think I'm about to give them a quiz, you know, which I never do. I don't tackle people and make them conjugate verbs or something like that. That doesn't happen. In some ways, I think there's less variety than people think. I like to think of it as a thing we have in common rather than something that separates us.
So what have you noticed so far here? I mean, how is it going? And are there things that you have seen Alaskans have trouble with, or, you know, a question that comes up with us?
I don't have enough of a sample size because it's been kind of rainy.
That's low.
We're trying to coordinate with the sun. Now the sun has been coming out more and more even as we've been speaking. So no, I mean, I was outside a coffee shop yesterday and people came up and we talked about some of the same things I've talked about in other places. Like one of them was affect and effect with an A versus an E, like that kind of stuff. And then I had another teacher come up and we talked about, you know, her what she does with her students. So, I mean, we're all doing a lot of the same things. And I hope in a way that the table serves to remind people of this wonderful medium we have in common, which is language. It's pretty exciting.
That was Ellen Jovin, the roving grammarian behind the Grammar Table. Find out more at grammartable.com. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Anne Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Catherine Monahan in Petersburg, Desiree Hagen in Homer, and Reagan Miller in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby. Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
If you are a hunter, birder, or outdoor enthusiast, the U.S. Geological Survey is asking for help tracking the bird populations in Alaska. The USGS manages a nationwide bird banding program, and every year, thousands of birds are marked with small, numbered leg bands. If you see, find, or harvest a banded bird, please report the band number online at reportband.gov. The information provided will help inform how bird populations may be changing. This message sponsored by the USGS Alaska Science Center.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.